All right, Erev Tov, everybody. We're going to start. A pleasure to welcome to see everybody and to welcome Dr. Moshe Sokolow, who spoke so beautifully on Sefer Iyov in our 24 and 8 series. And we invite him back, which I think is a unique series. I'm not aware of anywhere else where they have a shiur on the Haftarah of the week. It's not something sort of that's often done. So I think we're looking forward to an ongoing series. Dr. Sokolow is the Associate Dean of Jewish Education at the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education at Yeshiva University. He holds the Fania Gottesfeld Heller Chair of Jewish Education. He teaches graduate courses, history and philosophy and on Jewish education and curriculum development. He's taught often on areas of Tanakh. He's a prolific author, and it's really a pleasure to welcome him back, and we look forward to many insights over many upcoming weeks. Bakasha, Dr. Sokolow, it's all yours.
Thank you so very much. Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's an unusual opportunity for me, too. I have been giving a shiur on Parashat HaShavua now for more than 35 years, and not on the Haftarah. So let's look forward to the next 35 years. Okay. So give me a moment here to get my screen up and to make sure that everybody can see it. So Rabbi Kalman, can I just ask you on behalf of the audience, you see the screen?
Comprehensive Etymological Dictionary of the Hebrew Language.
That's it, okay. All right, so I'd like to begin just by a definition of terms. If we're going to be spending time talking about Haftarah, or plural haftarot. So a decent point of departure would be simply definition. When I need to define words, and particularly when I'm interested in their etymologies, I use a very fine dictionary. It was done about, I guess maybe 30, 35 years ago by a Hungarian Jew named Ernest Klein. Something there is about Hungarian Jews that make them masters of Semitic languages. Going back, 120 years or more, Bechol Dor Vador, certainly one of, if not the world's leading expert in Semitic languages, will be a Hungarian Jew. I once asked such a Hungarian Jew exactly why it is that Hungarian Jews are such experts of Semitic languages. And the answer I got was that Hungarian is a very easy language to speak, but a very, very difficult and complicated language to understand. So that anybody who actually is able to master Hungarian, Semitic languages are a breeze. In any event, it's usually my point of departure for establishing the essential meaning of words. And if we look up the Shoresh, Pei Tet Resh, from which the word Haftarah derives, we find that it has a variety of related meanings. It means to open or to break open, to separate, in the sense that if you open something and if you take something out through that opening, then you have separated it, hence removal. And if that which you have taken out is something that was enclosed or kept within, then not only have you removed it, but you have also set it free. So indeed, we have a variety of different meanings and yet a common denominator amongst them. And as you see, as we go from one binyan or another, from one form of the verb to another, from the kal, the simple form of the verb, to the nif'al, a reflexive form, to the pi'el, an intensive form, and to the hitpa'el and the hif'il, which are either reflexive or extensive forms of the verbs, we find that, again, there are different nuances. And it is of the hif'il, the extensive form of the verb, that we find that most of the nouns that we are familiar with that come from the shoresh pei tet resh, they seem mostly to come from the hif'il. So we see a variety of them, and you can see that they're clearly highlighted here in blue. Words such as patur, that's a perfectly ordinary Hebrew word. something is either chayav, somebody is either chayav or patur. Chayav in the sense of being guilty, patur in the sense of being innocent. What does innocence have to do with opening, breaking open, separating, removing, or setting free? Indeed, that if you have been constrained by placed under a charge of something, right? Then if you are found innocent of the charge, then essentially you've been set free. So we have that perfectly ordinary form of the word patur. And then we have the word haftara and the word maftir. And obviously the maftir and the haftara are essentially two forms or two sides, obverse sides of the same coin. The person who is called last to the Torah reading on a Shabbat or on a holiday is called the maftir. And that is the person who, generally speaking, gets to read the haftarah. So if we can understand just why the last, the final reading on a Shabbat or a Yom Tov is called the maftir, that may help us to understand why the additional reading is called a haftarah. Okay, so that particular sense of the verb in the hif'il that I think is most germane to our inquiry, I have highlighted here in yellow, and that is not to open wide, not to exempt, not to set free, but rather to conclude. The final Torah reading is, of course, a conclusion to the day's Torah reading. Okay. From here, I went to something a little more specific. I went to the Oxford Dictionary of the Jewish Religion, a very, very fine one volume work whose entries are generally much shorter than those that you would find comparably in the Encyclopedia Judaica. But precisely for that reason, the Encyclopedia Judaica runs to 16 volumes, while this, as I said, is just a single volume. Furthermore, it limits its scope to things that pertain to religion. Okay. And the entry under Haftarah reads as follows, and you can see it. The custom of conducting regular public readings from the prophets goes back to Second Temple times, possibly to the Hasmonean period. We're about to check that ourselves in just a moment. It has been suggested that it was introduced during the persecution of Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, when the public reading of the Torah was forbidden. Its purpose was to conclude the Torah, the reading of the Torah, the main instrument for educating people and strengthening their faith, with words of consolation and promises of messianic redemption. In later times, the Haftarah portion was no longer necessarily a prophecy of consolation, but was instead suited to the occasion of its recitation. Thus, on a festival, the Haftarah is in some way connected with the day, while on Sabbaths, it is chosen on the basis of association with the Torah portion for that day. So we see that there is no definitive answer to the historical origins of the Haftarah, but there is some rather informed speculation, and that we also see that perhaps the purpose for which the Haftarah was originally designed is not necessarily the purpose in which it continues today. So let's have a look and see what are some of the earliest sources available to us that discuss the Haftarah. And let's see if, in fact, these are, and they will turn out to be, the sources from which the author of the encyclopedia article drew his information. The Avudarham, most people call it the Avudraham, but actually it's a combination of two Arabic words, Abu, that's usually easily recognizable, it means the father of. A darham is actually the Arabic form of the Greek word drachma, and it's a coin. And an Abu Darham is somebody who has a lot of money. You may remember the old joke, what do the letters PhD stand for? Papa has dough. So that's what an Abu Darham is. An Abu Darham means that Papa has dough. Okay. The Abu Darham, Rabbi David ben Yosef Abu Darham, lived in Spain during the 13th century, wrote a commentary on the Siddur, and is one of the earliest authorities on matters of Jewish liturgy. And this is what he had to say about the Haftarah. V'achar shegolalin sefer Torah, after the Torah scroll is completed and it is rolled up, korei ha-haftarah, then the haftarah is read, v'tzarich sheyeheba me'inyan parashat hayom. And the custom is that the subject matter of the haftarah should be suitable or appropriate for that day. V'lama maftirin b'neviyim, why at all do we have the custom of reading from the prophets? L'fisha gazru al Yisrael shelo yikra'u ba'Torah. Because, as we saw just a moment ago, there was a period of time during which there was an edict passed against the Jewish people, prohibiting the public reading of the Torah. U'keneged shiv'a shehayu olin likrot ba'Torah, ve'ein korim pachot mishlosha psukim im kol echad ve'echad. And since a minimal Torah reading for a Shabbat or for a holiday is 7 people called to the Torah with a minimum of 3 psukim, 3 verses for each person who is called to read. So the minimal Torah reading for an ordinary Shabbat is 21 verses. Okay. Therefore, tiknu likrot kaf aleph psukim b'nevi'im v'lo yifchot mehem. Therefore, the custom was to read a corresponding number of 21 verses from one of the books of the prophets. V'im nishlam hayinyam b'fachot mikaf aleph. If, however, the subject matter could be completed in fewer than 21 verses, Kegonin, he gives an example, Haftarat Shuva Shehiktana, the Haftarah of the Shabbat between Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim, the one that is a call for Teshuvah, a call for repentance, and it completes its subject in fewer than 21 verses. Then we don't really have to stick to the letter, as it were, of the custom, and we don't require a minimum of 21 verses. If the subject matter is concluded in fewer than 21, then that's adequate for our purpose. Therefore, the Abu Darham tells us, Nikreit Haftarah. It's precisely for this reason that this reading from the Nevi'im, from the prophets, is called a Haftarah, lefi shahayu niftarim ba mikriyat haTorah. Because with the reading of the 21 verses from one of the books of the Nevi'im, one took leave of the Torah reading. Rabbeinu Tam katav tam acher. However, there are other interpretations of the word haftarah, and he attributes one of them to the leading authority of Ashkenaz of the High Middle Ages, Rabbeinu Tam, grandson of Rashi. Lama nekret haftarah, who in response to the same question, why is the prophetic reading called a haftarah? L'fi shamrinom b'sota b'perek ve'elu ne'marim, because in the Talmud it says, kevan sheniftach sefer Torah, asur ladaber afilu b'dvar halacha. But from the moment that the Torah reading commences, it's prohibited for the congregation to speak, even to exchange words of Torah. Sheneemar, and there's a proof text for it, ubifetcho, when the Torah scroll was opened, amadu kol ha'am, everybody stood, and the implication is that they stood silently. However, la'achar kriyat ha'Torah, after the Torah reading is completed, hutru liftoach ulidaber, it then once again becomes permissible to resume speaking. Vehu miloshon yaftiru bisafa umiloshon peterechem patuach. And therefore, Rabbeinu Tam adopted that approach to the meaning of the word haftarah that's more in line with what we saw in Ernest Klein's dictionary, namely that it has something to do with opening, with freeing up, so to speak. Okay? V'yesh omrim, however, there's even a third opinion that says shehu milashon ein maftirin le'achar ha-Pesach. There's a line that we may recognize from the Haggadah. Ein maftirin achar ha-Pesach afikoman. Therefore, we have two strange words. We have the word maftirin and we have the word afikoman. Okay? Lashon siluk min hadavar, which means not so much removal as it does departure. Klomar, so as to say, achar shekarua haftarah, after the haftarah was read, nistalku mitfilat yotzer umatchilin bitfilat musaf. This effectively concludes the shacharit service, and from now on, the musaf service commences. So one way or the other, whether the word haftarah has to do with taking leave, with departure, whether it has to do with opening, whether it has to do with removal. That is the name that was chosen for the accompanying reading, for the prophetic reading that accompanied the reading of the Torah on Shabbatot, on holidays, etc. There are, however, some other interpretations of it. Another one out of the late Middle Ages, from one of the leading authorities in matters Masoretic, things that pertain to the text, consonantal and vocalic text of the Torah, Rabbi Eliyahu Bachur, wrote, Shenim shematza katuv, that somebody found in a source that is no longer accessible to us, she'antiochus harasha melech Yavan, that's what we read about in the Oxford Dictionary of the Jewish Religion, that Antiochus IV, Epiphanus, Gazar al Yisrael, made a ruling or an edict, Shalo Yikru'u b'Torah b'Rabim, prohibiting the public reading of the Torah. Ma'asu Yisrael, what did the Jews do in compensation? Lakhu parasha achat minivim, they took a portion from one of the prophetic books. Be'inyana domeh li'inyan ma'shekatuv b'farasha shel Shabbatahi, whose subject matter somehow was related or pertinent to what would have been read from the Torah on that Shabbat, va'ata, therefore now, under those circumstances, af shebatla hagzerah, nowadays, that even though there is no longer such an edict prohibiting the public Torah reading, haminhag eno batel, the custom having survived for so long, remains in force. V'nikreit haftarah milshon hafsaka, and he subscribes to that one of the three previous opinions that derives the word haftarah from the notion of an intermission. Now, this question of the haftarah being, as it were, a bimkom, a replacement for the Torah reading, okay, implies that there would be no reason to read from the prophetic books otherwise. That's kind of strange. You know that we have a custom that on five distinctive points in the calendar, we read one of the five books of the Ketuvim, of the writings, the third constituent element of the Tanakh. We read from the scroll of Esther on Purim. We read from the scroll of Ruth on Shavuot. We read Lamentations on Tisha B'Av. We read Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, on Sukkot. We read Shir HaShirim on Pesach. It would be very strange if the Torah had a liturgical function, that it was a fixture of the weekly and holiday prayer service, if even these five Megillot were part of the liturgy, and yet the great works of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, not to mention all of the Treyasar, right? If somehow they just never made it into the synagogue, and that the only reason, the best excuse that somebody could come up with is that they filled in, they pinch hit for the Torah, So not surprisingly, there are alternative points of view. Leopold Zuntz, one of the fathers of the Wissenschaft movement, of the Jewish Enlightenment movement in Middle Europe, in Central Europe, and in Western Europe during the 19th century, and author of a book on drashot, on public sermons and homilies, wrote that there was no distinct historical reason for the Haftarah custom. Rather, he says, it was a natural development of Torah reading due to the inherent importance attached to the prophetic readings themselves. We don't need an excuse to give our respect, to honor the book of Samuel or the book of Joshua in the prayer service. A different interpretation was given by Rabbi Fishman, also known as Rabbi Maimon, the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the State of Israel, who in a book devoted to holidays and festive occasions, wrote again that it's unlikely that the Greeks would have prohibited Torah reading and yet permitted the public reading from the prophets. Therefore, he suggests that the custom may indeed have originated during the Hasmonean era, during the Greek period, but was directed against the Samaritans. The Samaritans rejected the prophetic writings, with the exception of the book of Joshua, and therefore the custom of reading publicly from one of the Nevi'im on Shabbat and on holidays was to emphasize their sanctity and to make the point that they were as important as the Torah itself. And another, and our final attempt to get to the bottom of the Haftarah comes from Rabbi Yisachar Yaakov Jacobson, or Yaakovson, who's one of the few Jewish scholars who actually wrote a book on the Haftarot. He wrote a two-volume work. It's called Chazon HaMikra. The word Chazon, visions, of course, referring more specifically to works of the prophets of the Nevi'im than to any other portion of the Tanakh. And he makes the following observation. First of all, I hope that this doesn't come as a surprise to all of you. And if it is a surprise, I don't know whether it'll come as a pleasant one or as an unpleasant one, but our current custom of concluding a Torah reading annually is not the original custom. It was the original custom of the Babylonian exile, and that's why it subsequently became the custom not only of all Jews living in the diaspora, but eventually became the custom of the land of Israel as well. But before there was the Babylonian custom of an annual Torah cycle, and even for a significant amount of time after the annual cycle was initiated in Babylonia, the Jews who lived in the land of Israel, and for that matter, Jews living elsewhere in the world, in the diaspora, but who are committed to following the customs of the land of Israel, they operated on a triennial cycle. That is to say that they concluded a Torah reading, they concluded the reading of the Torah in only 3 years. Now, simple math, right? If you complete a Torah reading in an annual cycle, then you have to have approximately 52 haftarot, one for each Shabbat. Of course, the number varies depending upon which days of the week the holidays fall on, but you need essentially 52 haftarot. If, however, you do not finish a Torah cycle for only 3 years, then do the simple arithmetic. You need 150 haftarot. Rather than having only 52 portions of the prophets, designated for liturgical use, you have over 150. So bearing that in mind, okay, Rabbi Jacobson points out that, of course, the triennial cycle maintained in the land of Israel until the Gaonic era has naturally three times as many haftarot. Now, the Cairo Geniza, I'm reasonably certain that with all of the wonderful offerings in Parshanot and in Jewish history that are available on Torah in Motion, I'm sure that I'm not the first person to use the word Geniza on Torah in Motion. The Cairo Geniza is a treasure trove of medieval Jewish manuscripts that were kept in storage in the attic of an ancient synagogue in Cairo. The synagogue is called the Ben Ezra Synagogue. It was removed. That is to say, this trove of manuscripts was removed only at the end of the 19th century. And therefore it was only during the 20th century primarily that Jewish scholars began examining them, and on the basis of these manuscripts, reconstructing significant points of the social, economic, and cultural history, not only of the Jews of Cairo and the Jews of Egypt, but the Jews of North Africa and the Middle East as well. And amongst the many, many things that have illuminated what were previously dark corners of Jewish life, due to the Geniza, is the matter of Haftarot, because one of the Geniza documents that have been published is actually a list of the 150 different readings from Nevi'im that altogether were the Haftarot for those Jews who, even though they lived in Cairo in Egypt, followed the customs of the land of Israel and completed their Torah cycle in 3 years. And Rabbi Jacobson points out that a list of these haftarot calls them not haftarot, but uses the term, the Aramaic word, ashlamta, like the word shalem, to be complete, or the word lahashlim, to fill in or to complete. So his suggestion is that the haftarot were so called because they were an integral part of the liturgical service and implied that the Torah reading was somehow incomplete without it. Okay, so much for the introduction to haftarot. Now, I have a question which I will invite you to assist me in answering, okay? Question is as follows. This is the Wednesday night in between the Torah reading of the Parashah of Bereshit and the forthcoming Torah reading of the Parashah of Noach. Which Haftarah should we be looking at? Should we be looking retrospectively at the Haftarah of last Shabbat, namely Bereshit? Or should we be looking prospectively at the Haftarah of this coming Shabbat, Parashat Noach?
Are you asking people to vote?
I'm curious as to whether if I go here and this says I can't see the
Noach.
Get myself.
So far, everybody says Noach.
Yeah?
Which is okay. What I would have thought too.
Okay, I see.
Go forward.
Noach,
even though we changed the clocks back,
okay.
Go forward. Okay.
All right. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. Okay? So just in case the vote went the other way, just to show you that I'd prepared something from the Haftarah of Bereshit as well. Okay. Now, of course, if you were either in shul last Shabbat or you followed the service at home, you know that we didn't read the specific Haftarah of Bereshit because last Shabbat was the Shabbat Mevarchim, who was the Shabbat on which we greeted the new moon and the month, and one of the first day of Rosh Chodesh was Sunday. and therefore the Haftarah that we actually read was not the Haftarah from the 42nd chapter of Isaiah, but it was actually a Haftarah from the book of Samuel. Okay, which is why I prepared that too, just in case somebody called me on it. But having done all of that, let me just go directly to the Haftarah of Noach and bring you all into it. And here we go. Okay. So I have a quick look at the clock. So here's an introduction. The Haftarah itself, let me show you, comes from the 54th and 55th chapters of the book of Yeshayahu. Okay. That is to say, it incorporates the entirety of chapter 54, as well as the first five psukim of chapter 55. Okay? So let me give a quick introduction to chapter 54, and then we'll look at some of the text, and we'll start with the question of why was this specific chapter of Yeshayahu chosen to be the Haftarah of the parasha of Noach. So if I were looking at Isaiah 54 as part of the book of Isaiah and completely independent of and unrelated to the subject of Haftarah, I would see a chapter that I would summarize with the words, no shame, no disgrace. That is to say, that the prophet Isaiah, speaking to the Jewish people and foreseeing for them a period of exile, a period during which they would experience shame and disgrace, offers them words of consolation, telling them that just as other life situations are reversible, so is their fate reversible, and that even though they are destined, as it were, to go into exile, that is not a permanent or eternal state of affairs, but it can be reversed. Okay. So in the chapter, he begins by comparing the Jewish people in their exile to a childless woman whose barrenness has been reversed. And indeed, that's the opening verse of the Haftarah. Rani akara lo yalada, that the akara, a barren woman who previously has not born children, rani, will be able to sing, will be able to rejoice. Pitzchirina, she will break forth in song. Vitzahali, and she will be able to sing aloud, lo chala, even though she previously has never been with child. Why? Because, as I said, her fortunes can be reversed. And indeed, the Navi promises, ki rabim b'nei shomema mibnei ve'ula. And indeed, there will come a day when the number of children who are born to mothers who were previously desolate will even outnumber the children born of mothers who had previously carried children. So again, as I said, it's all about the reversal of fortunes. And as you can see at the very top of the page, I just gave you a little bit of an outline of the chapter. The first three verses are allude to the expansion of the borders of Sion. Verses 4 and 5 are words of encouragement. You see verse 4, Al tir'i, don't be afraid. Verses 6 through 8 remind the Jewish people that God's anger is momentary, while his compassion, on the other hand, is everlasting. So these, again, are some of the themes that are struck within the chapter. Okay. Now we're getting closer to the association between the Haftarah and the week's Torah reading. This is the balance of chapter 54. As you see, verses 9 and 10 make reference to an oath or to a covenant that God had previously made. Verses 11 to 12, the rebuilding of Zion, and 13 to 17, that Zion once rebuilt will no longer suffer attacks, will no longer suffer wars and invasions, but peace will reign. And this is probably the verse that inspired whoever was originally in charge of making up the list of Haftarot to assign this Haftarah to the Shabbat of Noach. The Navi, speaking in God's voice, says, Ki mei Noach zot li. This reminds me, God says, of the waters of Noach. Put the words water and Noach together in a sentence, and the answer, of course, is the flood. God, at this moment, is recalling one aspect of the biblical flood. And what aspect of it is God recalling? Asher nishba'ati, an oath that God took. Me'avor me'noach od al ha'aretz. Never again to allow flood waters to cover the earth. And the point that is new here is that Cain, similarly, just as God previously punished mankind and punished them severely, right? And yet, once the punishment was carried out, God took an oath and swore never again to allow mankind to be destroyed by flood waters, okay? Cain, similarly, with respect to the Jewish people, to the audience of the prophet Yeshayahu, Cain nishba'ati, God is now taking yet another oath, miktsof alayech, he's swearing that he will not be angered by the Jewish people, umigorbach, nor to punish them or to rebuke them. Therefore, as it were, the Navi is encouraging the people to learn a lesson from history. If the lesson of history is that, yes, people who commit crimes against God, people who sin, will be punished. But having suffered their punishment and arguably learning the lesson of their punishment and repenting of their sins, can rest assured that God will not again cause them to suffer, so will the Jewish people, being addressed by Yeshayahu, have the confidence that if indeed they learn the lesson of their exile and they repent of their evil ways, that God will no longer seek to punish them. And he refers again in the very next verse, Ki heharim yamushu, even if mountains were to move about, which is an impossibility, v'hagva'ot timutena, and even if the hills were to be knocked over, which again is an impossibility, right? God says, even if these impossible things were ever to come to pass, chasdi me'itech lo yamosh, the graciousness that I show to you, my kindness to you, will never depart. Uvrit shlomi, and the covenant of peace that I am making with you, lo tamut, will never be removed. Amar merachamei Hashem, the voice of God here speaking as the voice of the rechem, the voice of compassion. The notion again of shalom recurs in yet another famous verse. V'chol banayich, all of your children, limudei Hashem, will be instructed by God. They will be educated by, as it were, by God himself. V'rab shalom banayich, and the peace and tranquility enjoyed by your children will be enormous, right? This is a pasuk that was subjected by the rabbis of the Mishnah to a rather fanciful homily that is actually incorporated into our liturgy on Shabbat morning. We say, Al tikre banayich ela bonayich. Not to read the verse as though it were only addressing sons, but to read it as though it were addressing bonayich, it were addressing masons. Anybody involved in the in construction, either in physical construction, in moral or spiritual construction, such as education, right? Limudei Hashem, and engages in the spreading of the word of Torah, Rav Shalom will be responsible in the way of receiving credit for the increase of peace and harmony in the world. Now, the reference here, okay, to the Mei Noach is the reference, and you can see the two penciled notes in the margin. That's simply my cheap way of not having to type it in, okay? References to chapter 9 of the book of Genesis, verses 11 and verses 15, which makes specific reference to this oath, right? The oath of V'lo yiyeod ha-mayim l'mabul al ha'aretz, that never again will the entire world be engulfed in a flood. But in verse 11, when God makes reference to this oath, he calls it not an oath, but he calls it a covenant. V'akimoti et briti etchem, that I will keep, I will fulfill my covenant with you. And of course, the sign of the covenant, we all know, is the rainbow. I wanted to say a word about covenants, but I have nothing better to say about covenants than two very significant Jewish political philosophers of the middle to late 20th century have had to say about it. One is the late Daniel Elazar, a leading political scientist, not only in the Jewish arena, but in the public arena as well, who wrote extensively on the idea of covenant, and recommended covenant as a medium social and political life in general, not only within the Jewish community. And here, in his definition, he tells us that in modern law, covenant is defined as a promise or agreement under consideration or guarantee between two parties, and the seal or symbol of guarantee is that which distinguishes covenant from the modern contract. The fact that we have the rainbow as the sign or the seal or the symbol of God's promise shows us that this is not a contract, it's a covenant. What's the difference between a covenant and a contract? I turn to our second political philosopher, Saul Roth, once upon a time, rabbi of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue and professor of political science at Yeshiva University, who says very clearly, what is the difference between a covenant and a contract? A contract is hypothetical and conditional. In agreeing to a contract, we express our readiness to assume obligations on condition that the other party to the contract also assumes obligations towards us. And if the other party refrains from fulfilling his obligations to us, then we are free of our commitments to him. And indeed, he points out that many philosophers have based their concept of democracy on the notion of a contract, as in the famous notion of a social contract. Citizens in a society enter into a contract in order to gain a certain number of privileges. It is a contractual, that is to say, a conditional agreement. The Jewish approach, Rabbi Roth tells us, is radically different because it is covenantal rather than contractual. And here you see the passage that I underline. The idea of the covenant is that we enter into a relationship in which we assume obligations unconditionally. When God made a covenant with mankind and promised never again would the world be engulfed in a flood, that was an unconditional commitment that he assumed. When we entered into a covenant with God at Mount Sinai, the covenant for our acceptance and our performance of the Torah and its incorporated mitzvot, that was a covenant. It was unconditional. Yes, God promised us that if we observe his covenant, then things will go well for us. And if we disobey the Torah, then we will suffer the consequences. But our agreement is not dependent upon anything. It's unconditional. It's part of a covenant. The conclusion of the Haftarah, the final five verses from Isaiah 55 rather than 54, were probably added to it because of the connection to water. Hoy kol tzameh luchu lamayim. Everyone who is thirsty, go to the water. Basher ein lo kesef, and even people who have no money, luchu shivru ve'echolu, come, you'll be able to obtain food to eat. Luchu shivru b'lo chesef uv'lo mechir, yayin v'chalab, you'll be able to obtain things to satiate yourself, to slake your thirst, even without having to pay for it. And the reference again underlined, v'echrata lahem brit olam, again, the notion of God's eternal covenant with the Jewish people. Rashi identified the water in the first verse here, luchu lamayim, with Torah, a very well-known rabbinic adage, right? Ein mayim ela Torah, that Torah is water, just as water is the source of all life, and without water, nothing can live. So is Torah the source of all life, and without Torah, certainly the Jewish people cannot live. And in that interpretation, he was followed by a slew of other medieval exegetes. However, a later French exegete, Eliezer of Beaugency, understood the water to signify whatever path provided the greatest possibility of success, just as a torrent of water can carve a channel through the earth and even through rock. So that too is whatever is the path that provides the greatest possibility of success. 18th century Italian commentator Samuel David Luzzatto took it as a symbol of the widespread success that would accompany the redemption, again, like a torrent, not a torrent of water that would be destructive, but rather, as it were, a torrent of people returning, as it were, from the exile to the land of Israel. And Malbim, 19th century Romanian, Central European Bible commentator, whom we will be looking at rather frequently, who generally had his own way interpreting prophetic literature, had a different take on the verse. And he tells us that the prophets compared Torah and mitzvot to lechem and to shever, to bread and to other provisions, because they sustain the soul just as bread and water nurture the body. And just as food for the body contains items that one cannot live without, such as water, which is obtained free of charge, and foodstuffs like bread, which ordinarily must be purchased for money, so it is, he tells us, with ideas and with deeds. There are things, ideas and deeds, that one truly cannot live without, such as the belief in the existence of God, God's providence, hashgacha, the avoidance of certain deeds that even civil religion would have us avoid, such as murder, robbery, and the like. All of these things resemble water because these are things that we cannot live without, as well as things that resemble bread, such as the study of Torah and mitzvot and the performance of such constant mitzvot as prayer and Shabbat and the like. And just as in corporeal and physical terms, there are things that one can live without and which were created only for the purpose of indulgence and pleasure, so are there soul foods that pamper the soul, such as intellectual knowledge and all the truths that are derived from analysis and mitzvot that promote piety. They, these other things, things that are not necessarily required to sustain ourselves, but are more like indulgences and pleasures, they resemble the yayin v'chalav, the wine which is on either milk. Some say the chalav is not milk, but it's chalev, it's fatted meats that are there only for our pleasure. So, what have we learned this evening? We've learned this evening the origin of the Haftarah, possibly, but not necessarily in a specific historical circumstance in which the Jewish people was prevented from engaging in public Torah readings, but somehow were nevertheless able to substitute readings from the books of Nevi'im, or that it was a practice that was instituted for another reason, perhaps even just for the reason of ensuring that the books of the prophets would continue to be given the respect that they deserve. Lest somebody come along and say, well, if they were really important, we'd be reading from them in the synagogue on Shabbat. So let's go ahead and read from them in the synagogue on Shabbat in order to make sure that everybody appreciates their importance and their sanctity. We've seen that there are several interpretations to the word Haftarah itself. The one that seems to be subscribed to most widely takes it from the idea of taking leave, that we take leave, as it were, from the process of Torah reading or from the entire Shacharit service through this concluding reading from the books of the Nevi'im. We've also seen that, generally speaking, the Haftarot were chosen because they somehow align with a subject that was prominent in that week's reading. We've seen that here. Whether we will continue to see that on an ongoing basis remains to be seen. We've also seen, and this perhaps is, I would say, the most significant of all of the lessons, even though this evening it may not have been the one on which we spent the most time because we needed an introduction, we've seen where the Nevi'im expand upon the Torah. In the Torah, the story of the flood occupies just one specific historical niche. It's something that occurred later than the era of Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel and the creation, on the one hand, in an era that was earlier than the emergence of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, on the other hand, okay? It's in somewhat of a twilight era between the earliest times and the emergence of a Jewish people. And therefore, there's an inclination to kind of see it as archaic or arcane. Yeah, once upon a time, there was a flood. As a matter of fact, you may know, if we look at this anthropologically, I don't know that there is a significant human civilization still extant on Earth today, part of whose mythology does not include a flood. So the tendency is either to situate the biblical flood in the remote past, or to say, oh yeah, floods. Everybody knows about floods. Because once upon a time, there was a lot of rain and things got washed away, and therefore everybody has a recollection of a flood. So it's either an arcane historical event, or it's just something that's the product of a myth. Yeshayahu and other Nevi'im took it and expanded it and made it into a metaphor for morality. The important thing is not the waters of the flood, as it is the flood itself as the instrument through which God made it clear that his law was to be obeyed and that disobedience to his law incurred consequences, severe consequences, destructive consequences. That, I think, is something that we can anticipate seeing on an ongoing basis. looking for where the intersection between that week's Torah reading and that week's Haftarah is elaborated on in the Haftarah, in that Navi, and made and transformed from what might have just been initially an historical fact into a significant moral lesson. With that, I conclude, and let me get back here to all of you. Ooh.
Hit the stop share button.
I know. There you go. Okay.
There are one or two questions you may want to take a look at.
Yes, I am looking. Okay. Oh, the word is parasha, but you shouldn't call it either of them. Actually, a weekly Torah reading, the technical name for a weekly Torah reading is a sidra. In a sidra, there may be several parashiyot. Okay, a parasha, there happen to be weekly Torah readings that consist of only a single parasha. We've just gone through a couple of them, right? Like Ha'azinu, right? Which is a single parasha, okay? But most of the time, overwhelmingly, a Torah reading consists of several parashiyot. Technically speaking, a parasha is a Torah portion, which if you looked in a Torah scroll, is a separate paragraph. Or if you looked in a well-edited printed text of the Torah, has the letter pei for parasha at the end of it, okay? Letter pei can stand either for ptucha or stuma. It's a little more complicated than that, but generally, so therefore, a weekly Torah reading, which consists of one or several parashiyot, should actually be called a sidra. Okay. Somebody actually said that. Thank you. Look at that. If I had read that before I read the first question, I wouldn't have known to answer it. Okay. God is bound by covenantal law. Yes. God is bound by covenantal law because it's a covenant into which he entered of his free will. Any covenant which is entered by the parties through the exercise of their free will is binding on them mutually. That is the point of the problematic Talmudic passage in the Tractate of Shabbat that I think is largely misinterpreted. It seems to say that when the Jews stood at the foot of Mount Sinai, God took the mountain and held it over them and threatened them, right? Im tekablu et haTorah mutav, if you accept the Torah, fine and dandy. Ve'im lav, but if you reject it, sham tehei kavuratchem, I'm going to drop the mountain on you and bury you. Okay? And indeed, one of the Babylonian Amoraim comes over and says, whoa, wait a minute. If that's true, then we didn't accept the Torah voluntarily, and therefore our entry into the covenant was not voluntary. And therefore, he says, Mikan moda'a rabba la'oraita, this is really an excuse. Anytime that God would want to punish us for our disobedience, all we have to do is give a collective shrug of our shoulders and say, what do you expect? We were forced, we were coerced, okay? So the Talmud is all frantic, and the best that it can do is come up with a pasuk, with a verse in the book of Esther that suggests, if you follow their reading, that the Jews in Persia during the time of Mordechai and Esther kiyamu v'kiblu, that they re-established or reasserted their willingness to enter into the covenant. So that certainly means that from the time of Mordechai and Esther and on, the Jewish people's acceptance of the covenant was voluntary. Doesn't tell you what covered the Jewish people from the time of Mount Sinai until the time of Mordechai and Esther. by the time of Mordechai and Esther, the first temple had already been destroyed. How could the temple have been destroyed and the Jews sent into the Babylonian exile if their observance of the Torah was under duress? So I think it's not my original thought. I will attribute it to its original author, Yosef Heinemann, one of the leading scholars of the Agadah of the last century, who says that what happened here is that a Babylonian Amora simply misunderstood an Eretz Yisrael tradition. The Eretz Yisrael tradition maintained that if the Jewish people had not accepted the Torah at Mount Sinai, all of existence would have ended, because the world exists only for the sake of the Torah. How do I know that? I only have to look no further than the first word in the first verse of the first chapter of the first book of Tanakh. That word is Bereshit. And as Rashi and the Midrash remind us, the word Reshit is a nickname for the Torah. Hashem Kanani Reshit Darko. God's very, very first possession was the Torah. Bereshit, by means of the Torah, or for the sake of the Torah, Bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. God created heaven and earth. No Torah, no excuse for heaven and earth. Therefore, the sense of the original legend was that God was telling the Jewish people that they are the last hope of mankind. The Edomites had already rejected the Torah. The Ishmaelites had already rejected the Torah. If the Jewish people had rejected the Torah, everything would have come to an end. Okay? That's the true meaning of it. What happened in this case, as I said, is that one of the Babylonian Amoraim, Babylonians tended to be much more meticulous in their reading of the law than the Jews of the land of Israel were. The Babylonians lacked a certain sense of poetry. And therefore, they read this legend. They didn't read this legend poetically. They read it legalistically. And therefore, their concern was, how can we be held responsible for the Torah if we accepted it under duress, without realizing that that wasn't the original intent of the legend? Okay, that's it.
Okay.
We've gone through the questions. I thank you all for joining us. Look forward to next Wednesday night at 8 o'clock, same time, correct, same station, as they used to say. I remember from television of my childhood. Remember that?
The Torah in Motion Zoom, E-Team Zoom station. Yes, that's it.
That's it.
Stay tuned. Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Shuli Miskin, Modern Finds in an Ancient Land, Tanakh and Archaeology, that's tomorrow at 11. 8:30 tomorrow night, not 8 o'clock, our sort of other more usual time, 8:30 tomorrow night at our Parsha, which I'll be giving again. I didn't think originally I was, but I'm going to be giving it again on Parsha. We're going backwards from the Haftarah to the Parsha. And then next week, already Joel Finkelstein, we have a whole rotation coming. So tomorrow, 11 a.m., 8:30 p.m. Next week, we start Sunday morning, Rabbi Liebtag, our whole series of classes that we had. And we look forward to seeing you. Invite your friends. Thank you again, Doctor, Rabbi, for the illuminating words. And, the overview of the Torah, I think, was very, very important that everybody sees. So we look forward to seeing you next week. And everybody have a wonderful day, and we look forward to seeing you tomorrow and in the future.
Jay, before you